This episode is sponsored by BetterHelp. Ernest, what's up? Look, quick question. How is your social battery doing right now? I'll be honest, mine is a bit on the low side. Maybe it's not setting enough boundaries or just a typical slowdown after our super hectic work schedule. It's so easy to overlook our social needs or overextend ourselves, isn't it? What's your ideal balance of socializing? And how do you recharge? Whether you find energy in crowds or need more time to yourself, understanding your social needs is crucial. I remember a time when I struggled to balance my social engagement with my personal downtime. Y'all know us, we're always outside. So what really helped me was learning to recognize my limits and prioritizing my well-being. I've heard plenty of my peers champion therapy as a great tool for gaining this kind of insight. It's not just for big life issues. It's also about enhancing your day-to-day life by equipping you with the skills to manage your social energy effectively. So if you're considering therapy, why not check out BetterHelp? It's an entirely online service, making it incredibly convenient and adaptable to your lifestyle. Just start with a quick questionnaire and you'll be matched with a licensed therapist. And if you feel the need to switch therapists for any reason, you can do so at any time without any extra cost. Find your social sweet spot with BetterHelp. Visit betterhelp.com/earnyourleisure today to get 10% off your first month. Remember, that's BetterHelp, HELP.com/earnyourleisure. Don't wait, don't hesitate, head over there now.
Hey there, did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
All right, guys. Welcome back, EYL.
Yeah.
We back home in the headquarters. And we have a very interesting conversation. You know, anytime that we get to talk to entrepreneurs, investors, it's always insightful. But today we have Arlen Hamilton, founder of Backstage Capital and invests in diverse founders. So venture capital, right?
That's right.
So VC is something that we've been talking a lot about recently as far as there not being a lot of black VC firms and how little of the VC and private equity capital goes to black founders.
That's right.
I think it's like 1.5% goes to women and minorities combined, every single person. So I would assume that black people will probably get way less than that, right? So literally fighting for crumbs in the billion-dollar industry when it comes to venture capital and private equity. So there's obviously a lot of issues with that. Then you're also an author. You have a podcast called Your First Million, right?
I do.
Really just championing, you know, the tech industry and the VC side, startups and entrepreneurship. So I'm sure there's a lot of things to talk about. So thank you for joining us. Appreciate it.
Thanks for having me.
I so thought you were going to say it's about damn time.
Oh, yeah.
I thought he was going to go there.
That's my first book.
But it's about damn time. We've been seeing and running into each other throughout the years. Watching you has been incredible. Watching your Instagram has been even more fulfilling. And I love it. I love the initiative. 1,000 new millionaires. I feel like, you know, there's a new class, and we talked about it, you know, numerous times about this financial revolution and everybody that's doing the work and everybody doing their part. So just want to let you know that we're watching the work. We've been studying the work, and we salute you and everything you've done. So thank you for being here.
Really, I appreciate really that. Thank you.
Yeah.
So where does this start for you? So we talked about the things that you're currently doing, but where does the journey begin, and specifically, how do you get into VC world?
Yeah, I'll take you back about a decade ago. About 8.5 years ago, I was sleeping on the floor of the San Francisco airport. That was where I lived, was at the airport. And it wasn't because I was trying to, like, you know, I was being cute. I put my stuff in storage and was going after the dream. It was because I didn't have anywhere to live. It was the safest place I could think of.
Where are you from originally?
Originally from Dallas, Texas. Born in Jackson, Mississippi, but raised in Dallas, Texas. Consider that my home. I live in LA. But at this point, I had been in mostly in Pearland, Texas, right as a part of Houston. And then I made my way to San Francisco to be in Silicon Valley. But I, at that time, was broke, as they say. The technical phrase for it is broke. And before that, so the reason I got into it, and I'll tell you, like, if you fast forward today, so nobody feels sorry for me, I've invested in more than 200 companies led by underrepresented, underestimated founders. We have the largest portfolio in the country by number of portfolio founders when it comes to diversity. And we, I personally invested in 30 different venture funds that are led by women and BIPOC founders or general partners that were started after Backstage Capital, my fund started. So we have inspired that as well. But it was probably 2011, 2012, where I was early 30s, still broke. And this is before San Francisco. And I had figured out what a startup was because I'd seen people like Troy Carter, Lady Gaga's manager, is a black man. Justin Bieber and Ellen DeGeneres and Ashton Kutcher, they were all making these small investments in a place called Silicon Valley. And they had stickers and shirts they were wearing. And I was like, what is that? So I was interested in it. And I had been on the road actually with musicians at that point. It was a whole nother story. But I was seeing them make investments like CeeLo and Toni Braxton and a few others. And I said, oh, okay, these are my people, like Silicon Valley startups, entrepreneurs. That's what I am. I just never knew what to call it. I didn't know I was a founder. And I also saw people like like Brian Chesky from Airbnb and Richard Branson, of course, I knew for a long time, knew of. And I was like, that resonates with me. That's what I feel like. I'm sure y'all can relate to that. You feel like this entrepreneurial spirit. I just never had a name for it. And so I said, I'm going to go out and raise $1 million because that's what you're supposed to do. So I started researching how do you raise $1 million for a tech company. And that's when I found out that less than 10% of all venture funding in the United States goes to women, people of color, LGBTQ+. I identify as all three. And so I said, that doesn't make any sense when white men make up only 30% of the country, they get 90% of the funding. So instead of raising $1 million for my company, I said, what if I could raise $1 million and invest it in those three categories? And what would that do? And what if I could build that over time? So I set out for several years to try to do that, didn't get any traction. But then fast forward to sleeping on the floor of the airport, making my way to Silicon Valley, knocking on doors, finally getting that first investment. And then I went from there.
What was that process like, right? So you're sleeping on the floors. In my mind, I'm thinking Pursuit of Happiness, but Right. So
Queen Latifah said the same thing.
That's the story, right? Just that hunger and that belief of, I'm going to make it. I'm going to figure this thing out.
Yeah.
I mean, there's a certain level of character that you have to have and integrity that you have to continue to pursue it. But how did you get the first investment? Did you even know how to pitch? Did you were you networking while you were going to and from the airport?
Right. So two things that I did while I was broke, hungry, that I encourage every entrepreneur to do, no matter where they are, is I kept up with my customer or my would-be customer, and my customer is the entrepreneur because I'm going to be investing in them. And I also learned every single day because there came a point where I was like, I can't control what's going on in my life. It's been like this my whole life in one way or another. I can't control. I'm so down, you know, but what I can control, like I can't control where I'm going to sleep, can't control where I'm going to eat necessarily, but I can control if I learn something new today. And so I made sure to do that. So I call it being money. Because money attracts money, but what if you don't have it? You become it. So I learned so much that I knew how to talk to investors because I studied it. And then the reason the first investor said yes was because I had more information than she had money, essentially, right? So she had a lot of money and I had a lot of information and I could help teach her. Like we would sit on the bench at this class we were in and I would just teach her like, this is how you do due diligence on a company. This is what you look for. And I was homeless at the time. She just didn't know it. So she had this money and she wanted to do something in the world. She wanted to invest, but she didn't know exactly how. So then when I taught her, she said, okay, let me actually back you. You go out and find the companies and let's see what that becomes.
So So as far as what was the first investment that you made?
The very first investment I made was in a company called Kairos out of Miami. It was a facial and emotion recognition company. This is 200 companies back, so I had to think about it. And Brian Brackeen is the founder. Black man who came from Silicon Valley but wanted to go back to Florida to build his company, put his own $250,000 into the company, was working on deep tech and AI at a time when most people weren't talking about it, could not get investors. And I just happened to find him on a YouTube video talking about it. And so we worked together before I had money, and then I you know, wired him as soon as I had it, $25,000. He went on to have his mostly white board push him out after a few years. And they thought that that was going to be the end of it. He turned around, he built a $50+ million venture fund to invest in people like himself, which I became one of the first investors in that. And then, and now he has, you know, an incredible sprawling empire essentially in Cincinnati and in St. Louis for black and brown founders.
The first investment, 2015, Backstage Capital is founded.
That's right.
The first investment happens when?
A couple of days later. Like,
oh, right, right.
Yeah, right. Because I had been working with founders, right? Like, I kept up with my customer.
Yeah.
I kept, so I knew the queue that I wanted to invest in. I was just missing out. Every few weeks, it was like, oh, you know, the opportunity was gone.
So how are you, how are you finding founders to invest in? I know you said YouTube was a video. Were you looking at incubators? Were you looking at Y Combinator and all these things?
Yeah.
And using your resources? And how are you figuring out which people and where they were at to invest in?
So although I knew Sam Altman at the time because I found my way to him, I was not looking at Y Combinator because Y Combinator was not looking for us. Mm-hmm. So I was not looking there. I was looking at, like, when I was in Pearland, I went to different places where it would be mostly white founders, but you would find the women, you would find the people of color who were the only ones in the room, and I would work with them. If I found something online, if I read the right article at the right time, I would just reach out to them early, early, early and just offer to help. Can I help brainstorm with you? Can I help make some introductions? Even though they weren't, you know, my network is so different now, but it was like I would make an introduction to maybe some press if I could find the email address. I was just trying to be valuable to them. So they would then tell their friends who were starting companies, and I would look through the companies and say, this one has potential, so let me really see if I can help before I have the money.
So when do you really start to hit your stride and start to take off in the VC world?
I think, so I had a viral Medium post in 2015, actually while I was still living at the airport before the first investment, called Dear White Venture Capitalists.
So why let's talk about this a little bit. Why were you homeless? Because you obviously, you went to Silicon Valley for a reason. So you're educated enough to understand the dynamics of what's going on. So I think it's important to speak about that. A lot of times people look at homeless people and they think that if you're homeless, you're on drugs, you have a mental illness, you're lazy, you don't want to work, or you're just very uneducated and kind of, you know, they don't look at somebody that can actually be, like, it could happen to you, right?
Yeah,
like,
you're right.
You could be educated, you could go to college, and then a couple of things happen, and then before you know it, you're homeless. So can you talk about your like, how did you end up in that point?
I had never, like many of us, I had never really learned about finances as a child. And I know that's not the case for y'all because that's y'all are teachers, right? Y'all are teaching other people, but many in your audience wouldn't have. And so my mom is an amazing person, but she just didn't know how to like make ends meet. She had like two or three jobs and it was just never working out. So I kind of went out of that again, like a lot of black households. My credit was not right as soon as I was 18 because it was used by different people and my family to, you know, do the thing. And so I kind of just started, I was just never ahead of the game. And on top of that, I'm highly unemployable because I would go and work places and I would have like, you know, $7 job and I would be telling the owner what to do. Because that's just how I saw it. I was like, you know, you could really put this over here and then more people would see it and da 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 da. And so I got into a lot of arguments and fights with people. At the same time, I also didn't have a wardrobe. Now, I still don't, but people don't care when you have receipts, right? So I didn't have a wardrobe to go and, like, I could type 100 words a minute and I could go and get, like, these temporary data entry jobs. But I would wear the same thing, almost the same thing every day, or, you know, same shoes for 7 years. So it was a lot of that and just not getting out of it. And also having this entrepreneurial spirit, whereas I always trying something in the lab. I sold like thousands of t-shirts in my 20s, but I never made any profit because I didn't understand unit economics. So I had a lot of potential and I was really, really bright, but I didn't have that right path. That's why it's so important to me today to provide that path for people, not just about investing in people, because it's not about going out and just handing money to people. It's about teaching a person to fish. How do you get out of that, on your own, saving them years of their time? So that's where I was. And then I had been living actually with my mom in a hotel. She was in her 60s at the time. She's 74 now. I was in my 30s. I was like, it was dark, it was not cool. And I just sent her back to Mississippi to stay with her sister on a couch. Cause I was like, I can't watch my mom like out here like this. And so I went west, sent her east from Texas. And that's when I said, I'm putting the clock on this. There has to be something that happens. Cause I don't know how I'm going to live like this for too much longer.
Yeah. So in terms of, I know you want to make sure that underrepresented founders have capital. I wonder what the investment philosophy was for you at the beginning, mm-hmm. right? What were you looking for in founders? It sounds like they, number one, had to be inquisitive, I feel like, but they had to have a willingness to learn. What were the initial things that you were looking at in a founder to say, this is somebody I think has some growth?
The overarching idea, thesis, was underrepresented. And we say underestimated now because we've coined that phrase at Backstage, but underrepresented at the time. I was saying, in my pitch deck and when I was talking to investors, we have done so much with so little. What happens when we have more? That was the overarching thing. So when I was looking at founders, first of all, obviously, if it just the product or service itself was compelling, that was something. And then I would look at, because I can't really measure them on their traction, so to speak, because a lot of them don't have the same resources at the time that someone else might have.
Earners, what's up? You ever wonder what's around the next corner? What happens if you push just a little further? With Nissan SUVs, you're equipped to take your adventure to unimagined levels. Imagine the possibilities with a Nissan Rogue, Nissan Pathfinder, or Nissan Armada. Go ahead, find your next big adventure. And while you're out there exploring the unknown, the class-exclusive Google built-in becomes your ultimate co-pilot. No need to fumble with your phone. With Google Assistant, Google Maps, and the Google Play Store integrated into the 12.3-inch HD touchscreen infotainment system of the 2024 Nissan Rogue, your journey becomes seamless. Ask for directions, stream your adventure playlist, or send messages hands-free, all while keeping your focus on the adventure ahead. This just isn't any drive. It's a journey powered by innovation, where the road less traveled isn't just seen, it's experienced. The 2024 Nissan line aren't just SUVs. They're your gateway to adventure, equipped with the tools you need to explore every corner of the world around you. Nissan, dare to do what others don't. Visit your local Nissan dealer or NissanUSA.com to find out more and take the first step into your next adventure today.
I'd say, what have you done with the resources you have up until this point before you met me? And I would measure it like that, kind of fairly. And that way it became a level playing field and a meritocracy, because then I can say, oh, well, this person, I didn't go to college. I certainly got into colleges, but I didn't end up going to colleges because I didn't want to leave my family broke. But I could certainly say, oh, this person didn't go to college, but they have this all lived experience. Or they're, a lot of times it's for women, they'll get asked, I've seen it happen. They get asked, well, how are you going to run your company with a child? Are you planning on having kids or whatever? And I'm like, no, the opposite is true. They're a multitasker. They know how to, look at things in a different way. They know how to make ends meet. So I would just look at things from the point of view of the women and the people around me who I grew up with and what their potential really was.
Just a follow up, because I'm thinking it's kind of double sided, right? It's almost like an interview process for you, but also for them.
100%.
Right? Because at the initial stages, you don't have anything that you're invested in either. So they have to figure out how to, is this somebody that I should have on the capsule?
Well, that's why at the beginning, before I had money, I just made myself valuable to them. Okay. And then by the time I came around to invest, they were running around saying she has to be, somebody give her some money because she is finding all these great companies and she's so helpful. So I had like, it was like a groundswell of support by the time I got that first check. Yeah. And that's how I was able to keep going and keep raising. Because they're called limited partners or LPs. Mm-hmm. They would reach out to some of the founders and say, you know, talk to us, you know, back channel. And I had just a reputation for being helpful, even when it didn't make sense. And there are plenty of times where I could have invested if I had the money, but I didn't have the money. And those companies have gone on to sell to Amazon or do all kinds of crazy stuff. So those early days, there are a lot of receipts.
So, okay. So let's talk about VC. So what do you look for when investing in a company?
So I look for what their product or service is, just interest, because all of it is gut at the end of the day. Obviously, you can do all this projecting and all kinds of modeling, and we do that at Backstage Capital. But for me, I go back to my roots of, you know, I treat it a little bit like American Idol or The Voice or something. It's like, what am I feeling from this? And my instincts have been pretty good so far. And then today at 43, I say, if I had 10 years, could I do this on my own? Could I do this myself? If the answer is yes, it still may be a great company, but it's not as compelling to me because time is limited. But if the answer is no, I could not personally figure this out on my own and do it, then I have my attention because then I can live vicariously through them. I can live through what they do and I can say, okay, that's like a moonshot. That's like that could change the world or change lives. So it doesn't have to be an impact company, but it has to be something that is so compelling that I couldn't personally do it.
What were the emotions like when you, as you were speaking and knowing that there's a company that you know is going to be one of the substantial pieces of the future of the world?
Yeah.
And you see it at the doorstep, but you don't have the capital to be a part of it.
I can tell you an example.
I'm thinking 2015, I'm thinking the Ubers of the world, the Airbnbs of the world.
Yeah. You know, I'll tell you an example. Yeah. Patreon. Patreon's worth, I don't know how many billion right now. If there's emails that I have where I'm talking to Jack and Sam, the co-founders, the first day they premiered, and I do what I do. I'm writing, because I was writing to all kinds of founders, mostly black and brown and women, but I reach out to them. I said, I love what you're doing. I used to be in the live music space. I know what this is. It's creator space. Let me get you coffee. Let me help you connect with angel investors, whatever. And they came back. There's email thread of this where they're like, cool, thank you. We're not looking to raise right now, but cool. Then a week later, Sam writes back and he's like, actually, Jack does want to raise. Can you help us raise $1 million? So I go out, I send them all these investors because I've been talking to investors who weren't investing in me, but I was like, you got to look at this. It's like Kickstarter, but it's different, you know. And then they talk to the angel investors. Then I send them to a top tier venture fund that's a very well-known venture fund in Silicon Valley. Send it to them. The venture fund says, it's interesting, but it's not that interesting. They say, we love it. You know, the company says, yeah, please introduce it. So I introduce them, but it doesn't go anywhere. 2 months later, I open up or maybe read online a Forbes article. That VC fund led their round. And so since then, I have been calling them out publicly and I've been saying either the venture fund, CRV, I'll say who it was, Charles Rivers, CRV, I'll say it right to them, or Patreon should do the right thing. And there's things called scouting fees and finder's fee, like that kind of thing. Mm-hmm. They should, I believe, give Backstage Capital, my venture fund, they should give the fund itself some equity in Patreon. Because I did write to CRV and I said, hey, what happened here? How did you all end up going from you didn't like it to you're leading their round? And they were like, oh, you know, making all these excuses. But they recognized that it was my introduction. Mm-hmm. So that's an example of it kind of being a negative. And I hope, you know, they do right by us at some point. But when it came to people like Jewel Burks with PartPick, I worked with Jewel for a while. She had a company that you can identify parts of, like, you know, auto parts and nails and different things on your phone and then find it for you. And this was, again, AI before everybody was talking about it. She was having a hard time raising because everybody I was talking to was. I helped her with a bunch of stuff. And then I just didn't have any money to invest, but I wanted to invest. A few months later, she went on to sell to Amazon and she became a millionaire overnight. And she's a really interesting person. She's an investor herself now. She invested in my fund after that happened. But that's one of those things where I'm just so happy for her and so happy for Nashley Cephas, who was her CTO, her chief technology officer, who also became a millionaire that day. And whoever else, you know, multiple other people who did. And I just look at that and say, I just told y'all. I mean, I was just telling all the investors, you should invest in this. And it went on to do well. So I don't look at that as, I don't get too emotional about that one. Mm-hmm. I think more it's just pride.
Yeah. Is it like a hunger that I got to get to this? Like, is there a part of it too? Or?
So I would say, like, the first, if I'm going to be just real honest with you, the first 7 or 8 years, so 2015 to 2021, I was like Sharky, you know, I have a joint venture with Mark Cuban. I'm always working on things. I've lost that a little bit when it comes to investing for a number of reasons. A little bit of it being that I am, you know, to say the truth, I am a trailblazer here. And so a lot of daggers in the back, right? A lot of scars from that. And it's been very difficult to do. And I love the progress that's been made. And I love to see all of the seeds planted, like, you know, seeing bearing that fruit. Mm-hmm. But it wears you out. It wears you out when you're doing that. So I'm very competitive, but I think it's not all about investing. Like, I'm competitive in different arenas now.
So, like, what are the economics in you investing into a company? Like, how does that work as far as you go? You say, I have $100,000. I want 10% of your company. And then they come back and they say, no, well, we want to only give up 5%. Mm-hmm. Like, how does this work as far as you going in and actually offering to buy somebody's company and
buy some equity? Yeah, usually they have a round that they're raising. So the company usually itself says, we want to go out and raise $1 million. And they know how much they want to raise for the reasons that they figured out internally. And then they go to investors and say, what exchange will you do for $1 million? Then you'll have in a good scenario, you'll have two or three, you know, lead investors come back to you with a term sheet that says, okay, we'll buy that on a $5 million valuation, meaning that's 20%, da, 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 da. And then the next one may say, we'll do it on a $6 million. So it's better for you. You get a little less diluted because we want the deal so bad. And so usually, like, the best case scenario is you have two or three lead investors vying to lead your round, and you take their terms. You don't necessarily take the terms that are most expensive. You take the terms that you feel like that's the company, that's the fund I want to work with. That's who I want to lead and represent. So we have that. And then you have other investors around it who are followers, who, like, you know, follow whatever terms have been created. So it's usually that negotiation. So most of the time, Backstage does not lead just because of the amounts that we're putting in, but we always advise. So it's almost like we act like we're on their board, even if we're not on their board, like, with their help.
Well, what are some of the, because you brought up challenges earlier, and I'm thinking to myself, we've heard about what it is to try to be a founder and raise capital, but actually having a VC and representing three categories, right? Like, yes, woman, yes, LGBTQ, yes, underestimated population. What is it like from that end? What are some of the challenges that you face, and how have you dealt with it? How have you overcome them?
A lot of people who just, you know, they talk and they say they're going to do something publicly. They get the picture or whatever, but they really don't do anything. But then there's really more like people actively trying to stop what I'm doing. Mm-hmm. So I had a white investor. I have a lot of white investors. And I had one guy who is, like, I don't know. I think he's kind of like mafia in Silicon Valley. Like, he's interesting. And I don't think he's literally mafia, but he can make a phone call and stuff gets done and stuff goes away. Right. And he called me in the middle of the night one time a few years ago. And he said, I just want to let you know, I just left a closed door, like, you know, poker game, essentially, with a bunch of guys who are very powerful. And there's an understanding that you're not going to raise more than, you know, $10 or $20 million ever in Silicon Valley. And I was like, okay, that was a conversation. Y'all had time for that? And he's like, no, I'm serious. He's like, the powers that be are like, there's only a few of us. Where? And the conversation, he's like, I said what I could, but I had to be able to not say certain things so I could come back and tell you. He's like, they don't want you to win. And look, I've raised $30 million, maybe 25, 24 of that has been direct LP money to invest in other companies. We should, by our track record, by the trailblazing part of it, the groundbreaking part of it, we should be at least a $100 million fund, if not 10 times the what we are, at least. And so I believed him when he said it, but I always thought I could break through that. I think that there's you see like Elon Musk and like how he's directly going after Cuban, talking about DEI is racist and all of that. That's what was happening behind the scenes. That's who I deal with. I've had so many conversations behind the scenes that are like a movie. They're like, I can't believe this person is saying this out loud to me. Or somebody calling me and saying, you know, you need to shut up. You need to stop being so vocal about stuff. It's not good for you. Like, Paul Graham at YC, speaking of YC. So I'm friendly with Sam Altman. I think he's cool. I've invested in OpenAI. Very happy about that. So Paul Graham, his mentor and the founder of YC, I do not like very much. And it's because he sicked his minions on me on Twitter. And I had to get security before I should really have had security. Because I said something he said about his wife. And I said it was very sexist and chauvinistic. And I just commented myself on it, you know, on Twitter, because I'm outspoken. And he just like came after me. And it's happened a lot, like with different people of note, it's happened, because I'll just speak up when I want to speak up. I feel like I have the moral high ground to speak up because I'm actually doing action and I'm not just pontificating and criticizing from the sidelines. Like, I feel like we could all be better. So I'm trying to be better. Why can't this billionaire be better?
So as far as like valuations, right? We talk about valuations a lot. Like, how do you guys look at the valuations? Because we were talking to one of our friends, John Henry, and he was saying a few years ago, like, depending on what kind of company it is, it has a different valuation, right? Like, yeah. If it's a hair company, their valuation might be a lot different from a media company. Mm-hmm. That might be a lot different from artificial intelligence, technology-based mm-hmm. company. And then part of raising the money is you have to raise on the valuation.
That's right.
Part, right?
Yeah.
So how do you know, okay, this is a fair valuation, this company's overvaluated, this company's undervaluated?
Yeah, John Henry is a good friend, and I've invested in his company and after he became a founder. So a lot of it is just like what the market will bear. A lot of it is a lot of people just deciding. Just to say, what can I push across the table and somebody says yes to, essentially. And it's kind of a joke in the industry, because it's like every year it's different. In 2022 and 2021, super frothy, super, everything was valued so high, ridiculously not sustainable. But everybody was like, okay, cool, sounds good, more money for us. And then when second half of 2022 and 2023, everything came crashing down, because you could understand that. Mm-hmm. Yeah. You go ahead and yawn. So the valuations, but the reason that the valuations are different is because the multiples on an exit or a purchase are usually much different. So a hair care product or a CPG company is going to sell different multiples than a SaaS AI company, meaning CPG, you might have like a 1.5x to 6x multiple on your net revenue. If somebody buys you. Mm-hmm. On a SaaS AI, you may have like 20x or 10x. So when someone's valuing you to invest in you, all they're doing is projecting. All they're saying is, okay, if I put $1 in, what's the best what's the best guess I can make as to what you'll sell for based on how you're doing today?
So is that from your perspective, is what is success? Is it a company to exit? Is it to create more millionaires? Is it to create more opportunities for founders? Again, from the three categories that we spoke about, how do you determine and measure success?
I love that question. To me, it's all three.
Okay.
That's it, right? For very, very sharky investors, they don't care about impact and they don't care about like people coming up.
Straight up.
Yeah, that's just not important to them. That's not necessarily bad, but it's just not my vibe, right? They're like, apples to apples, how much am I getting back? So that is a juggle thing. But I say, and many of us say, you can do both. And I just want to say one thing. You said earlier that there are not a lot of Black investors. So there's so many now, which I'm so excited about. You know, like 10 years ago, it was so different. But today, like that, like John Henry and I can be in a room and it's just packed, you know, back to back. Still not enough. But so you have within Black investors, you have some like 645 Ventures, Aaron and Nyambi. They are two Black men. They've raised, I don't know how much, more than $100 million. I can't remember, maybe $200 or $300 million. And they're like, let me put it into this spreadsheet and do these numbers and see what this company might or may not make. And I don't care. You know, it doesn't matter to me if you're a woman or if you're purple. I want to do that because my success as a Black man is then going to be my success story and help others, right? Mm-hmm. So I'm on the category, which I love that, by the way. I'm on the category of, I'm going to get this one shot. I'm going to just make this more well-known to people like you all are doing with your education, like more like being a bridge to understanding this with my audience, which is mostly women of color. And I'm going, so that's impact and success. That I have a video right now that I put up today. A Black woman comes up to me. She's crying. She's saying that she essentially saying that she felt heard and represented and seen because of the work that I do. And she said a tangible something that happened. That to me is like the biggest, that's the legacy. That's the thing that you can't take away. But I also not only want to, I feel like I have to make a lot of money from what I'm doing, even though we're not funded enough. I want to make multiples for our investors so that it serves as an example that you can do both. And it's high pressure, but I also agree that it should be high pressure.
So you say you raised $30 million. What's the process of raising money? Like, who is in your circle of investors, and how do you network and promote your fund to actually get money into it?
Yeah, so
Earners, what's going on? Listen, EYLU is relaunching, revamping, retooling. That's right. We're creating a new educational experience that's more expansive. Shadi, tell them what we got.
Yes, 2023. We got a lot in store, a lot planned for you guys. So you know that EYLU already includes monthly financial planning calls with me, book club calls with Troy, real estate calls with MG the Mortgage Guy, access to the Home Buying Blueprint, Volume 1 and Volume 2. Part of the revamp will include 27 local chapters from across the United States, live interactive teaching, hands-on, not just pre-recorded videos, plus 15 brand new curriculums.
The biggest just got bigger.
Head over to EYLUniversity.com. That's EYLUniversity.com. See you there.
It started out with that woman who, didn't have a lot of network. And so she was, she worked at a big company, and then she had some money from that. So she put in like an angel investor. But then she introduced me to her friend who happened to just be in a network. That friend happened to be like a tech person from Facebook who knew a man named Lars Rasmussen who co-founded with his brother Google Maps. So that third investor in 2015 or the top of 2016, and he's a very early investor in Canva. So he's just very, very successful and he sees things early. But that was kind of like the first like that I could see, oh, I'm going to be talking to people who have a lot of money and, you know, connection here. So I just spent, you know, every day, every waking hour reaching out to people, working with people. Then, like, maybe mid-2016, Stuart Butterfield reached out, the founder of Slack. He just saw what I was doing, and he wanted to be part of it. I reached out to Mark Andreessen because he said that something I wrote was interesting, and I used that as an opportunity to ask him to invest, and he ended up investing in three of my funds, like the smaller funds, which has been really cool. He has also blocked me on Twitter, so that tells you my life.
Why did he block you?
I have no idea. I have to ask him. I don't know. I should ask Chris. I should ask Chris. I should ask Chris. I know y'all are friendly with him. He blocks everybody. He blocks everybody. But I must have said something one day that upset him. Because I will call people out. Like, I call out Peter Thiel. I'll call out people who are, like, friendly. I'll call out Andreessen. I've called them out before. I've had conversations with Chris.
About what? What'd you call him out for?
And when George Floyd was murdered, Andreessen Horowitz, which is a multi-billion-dollar fund, announced their cultural fund.
Cultural Leadership Fund?
Yeah. And then they also announced this, like, $1 or $2 million fund, and it hurts me to say that word because it's not to me a fund that invests in Black people. I know what it's like to put together $1 million, so I'm not saying it's nothing. But when you have multiple billions under management, and your response to a Black man being murdered on TV is to say, "Here's this penny, less than a penny," I was offended as someone who had invested at that point in maybe 140 companies led by underrepresented founders. I still am offended by it. And in fact, I mean, I know the people who are all part of it. It's not like I'm over here just like mad at them and yelling at them. I've talked to all of them. I appreciate the work that Chris is doing. I appreciate the work that Nate did. Black men in these organizations. I just think that the organizations it's really interesting to me that they're run by white people, white men, and especially Ben Horowitz wants to be so close to the culture. And if he's your friend, I'm not trying to offend you, but he wants to be so close to the culture. But tell me, besides like two founders that I can think of right now, how many times have they put more than $10 million into a Black founder's company when they are those to invest in? That's their business. It's their money. But just like it's their business to not do that, it's my business to talk about it and to say it out loud.
So the overall goal for Backstage Capital, you said you raised $30 million, should be valued at $100 million. Is there a number? Are you looking to be a $1 billion fund? Like, mm-hmm. What is the goal, right? Because obviously, as you have more capital, you can deploy it.
Yeah.
It won't be 1,000 new millionaires. It'll be a million.
The 1,000 new millionaires comes from me teaching people how to fish. Mm-hmm. That's straight up. It's not about how many people I can invest in. Mm-hmm. But I think for everyone involved, our founders, for the LPs who've already invested and the ones who could invest, based on the deal flow that we have, the people we get to see, the access we have. I just told you, I invested in OpenAI. Nobody else got to invest in OpenAI, directly through them, right? Unless you had like $100 million, $50 million.
What year was this?
This year.
Oh, you did? Okay.
Obviously wish it was sooner, but but it's a thing though. It's like when Troy invested in Uber and Lyft. I think for everybody involved, we should be at least a $350-500 million fund under management within the next 5 years. That's what we should be, because we can deploy it. We have the access, we have the skills to deploy that. You don't always have to have so much money. Like Robert Smith has billions under management, your friend, right? Because he's a private equity investor. So he's making investments that are so much bigger than the kind we're making. So we don't have to be a $1 billion fund to be super successful. But I think that a $300-400 million assets under management is something that's exactly where we should be in the pocket.
So what's your track record for your fund?
The track record is that we are it's called TVPI, Total Value Paid In. That means that for every dollar that you've put in, what is that dollar worth on paper, essentially? So we're somewhere around 1.4, 1.5x hovering across 200 companies, which is pretty hard to track, but across that. So we haven't had any major exits. We have like three exits that have been small or aqua hires. We invest at the earliest stages. But if you look at the enterprise value of our portfolio, it's in the billions. which is incredible. Hundreds, if not thousands, of jobs created directly from our investment, and revenue is in, you know, the hundreds of millions.
So what would be your pitch for investors to invest in your fund? Like, what's the main thing that you would?
I certainly cannot pitch to investors. I can tell you hypothetically, because I'm not allowed by the SEC to sit here and talk about it.
I'm just saying, like, what makes your fund attractive, in your opinion?
We were, you know, the thesis that I had 10 years ago, 12 years ago, played out. I said, you can either be, you know, we've done so much with so little, you can either be crashed by the wave that's coming, or you can ride it. It's everything I've said has happened. There's a video of me in 2017 talking about what happened in 2022 and 2021. Like, it keeps happening. So it's been proven out. On top of that, there are multiple funds that have been created after us and with our mandate in our blueprint that have gone on to do well and who look to us for guidance. So we actually have all of the touch points. We have all of the deal flow and the network and the infrastructure that we've built manually, essentially. So everything that they're looking for those to find the companies, they don't have to do a thing. You know, come find the companies through us. Then we nurture the companies. They don't have to do that either. And then we are able to, the way we've already done, source the companies that then go on to have high enterprise value.
You brought up some of our alumni, Troy Carter, Chris Lyons, who has been on Market Mondays. Another alumni who's been on both is Mark Cuban.
Yeah.
He invested $5 million into your fund.
Six.
$6 million into your fund. Talk about how that relationship transpired and his belief in you.
Yeah, I mean, again, probably have to ask him. I don't want to speak for him, but I'll tell you what happened. I grew up in Dallas, so I've known about Mark for 20 years. And I also watched Shark Tank when I was, you know, broke and just always pretend I was a fifth shark or whatever. So just really admired him. And Twitter at the time, before it was X, they asked us to speak on a panel, like on a like fireside together at South by Southwest, because we both use Twitter in an interesting way. So that was 2019. We went out and I was toe-to-toe with him. You know, he doesn't like anybody to kiss his ass. Like he likes to talk to you like normal. And that's how we roll. And, you know, he got to meet my family. He's very kind to them. And so after it went really well, I said, hey, will you invest in my fund? And he said, no. And he said, I don't like to invest in other people's funds for the most part, because I like to invest directly into companies, having too much fun doing that. So I said, cool. You know, I've had multiple no's. So I was very respectful to him. A few weeks later, there was an article that came out in like Silicon Valley Press, whatever, TechCrunch, or it wasn't TechCrunch, it was Axios actually. And it said, it had like a really unflattering picture of me, as they do. And it said that my fund had failed because I wasn't able to raise it yet, raise this certain fund I was raising. So $36 million fund that I went out to raise, and I hadn't raised it yet. And then, so for some reason, they just on this day decided to write that. And that article, it didn't really accuse me of anything. It just said that I was a failure and that people had lifted me too high, said I was too good before they should have. And because of that article, a couple of our main LPs pulled out because they were like, what's going on back there? And I'm like, there's literally nothing. I have the DM of the guy who wrote me, asked about this, and he was so nice to me, but I didn't know he was going to write that. So I didn't do anything. Mark wrote to me. He sent me a DM and he said, I saw the article and he said, here's $1 million. So you can just do whatever you need to do, like make whatever investment you want to make. And he said, what we need to do is make you independently wealthy so you don't have to deal with this shit. Mm. And I was like, you are right. You're right. You are correct. And I appreciated him. Not only did he do that, he said, I said, okay, you want to do like a press release? What? He's like, no, nobody needs to know this. It's cool. You do whatever you want. If you want a press release, do it. If you don't, don't. He wasn't trying to get the accolades. And top of that, usually when you have a fund, especially a joint venture like that, or all the funds, you have 2 and 20, it's called. So 2% management fee that you get every year. This is like standard. It could be varied. But you get 2% management fee and then 20% carry, which is carried interest, short for carried interest, which is the profits you make off of your winnings. That's really standard. he said, management fee, whatever, we'll, you know, we'll get you operated, but we'll give you 30% profit share because this is a true JV. And I mean, he offered that and I just couldn't believe it because it's so, it's the kind of management fee that Andreessen Horowitz can command because it's so high. So I just thought that was, there was a lot of integrity on his part. And it was almost like, that was the thing that told me this isn't charity. I was like, this is actually him just like, I don't know. It was just really interesting. So then a year later, a year, some months later, George Floyd was murdered. And I just got an email from Mark. Of course, I had been talking the whole year. We talk about deals. We talk about whatever. I got an email from him. And it just said, the subject said, do you want to do more? Opened up the email. It said, I'm going to be transferring $5 million into our JV. So we can, he was livid about George Floyd's murder and the way that it was handled. And he wanted, that was his way of acting. That was one of his ways of acting because he knew I was, you know, we were already there. We had the infrastructure to handle that. And let me be real clear, like Marcus, he's very blunt. So he doesn't sit around. We don't sit around and giggle. Like we don't sit around and he's like, oh, you're doing such a great job. He's like, where is the path to me getting an ROI on this return on investment, right? He says that he's very specific. He treats me like he treats every other investment, which is I'm investing in you so you can give me money back. It's not a charity, right? He just makes sure that he spends his dollars the way he wants the world to be. Like he wants to put his dollars a certain way. So I asked him after that, first of all, I do want to do a press release. He said, okay, we can do a press release only if you go through this a woman of color's very indie publication that I invested in. That's the only way. I don't want you to go to TechCrunch or anybody else, USA Today, which I could have. Which again, one more step of like, oh, that's just really doing it.
It's intentional,
right? Yeah. Because honestly, I know $6 million is a lot of money. But Mark could have, if he wanted to, he could have like used that, been on every, like mentioned it every time he had an interview. And he would have made $6 million back in some sort of marketing, you know, something that would have come back to him. I just think he really just wanted to do it. So finally I asked him why he did it. And he said, you're in rooms I'll never be in. So it's just a the right play for me. And I get courtside. I mean, I buy courtside seats and to Mavericks. That's the only one because I love Mavericks now. I used to not know who Luka Doncic was. So there's like a podcast episode from like 2.5 years ago where we're talking about with Mark talking about it, and he's like, "Do you know?" I was like, "I don't know who that is." Wow. So I started watching after so many years. I know people are killing me right now. And I'm obsessed now. So like I'm
following the team.
Oh yeah.
Kyrie and all that.
Yeah. Oh yeah. Okay. And I'm always, you know, of course I'd or get a suite or whatever. And anytime I see Mark, it's all good. My brother just ran into him at the NBA. We were there. I just was in a hotel room at the NBA All-Star game. And, you know, there's love for my brother and my mom. And he's just really kind. And there's most of the companies he's invested in, he's never met the person. So for him to like 4, 5, 6 times make an effort to come over and hug me and just like say how you doing, in addition to all the emails that we do. I just really appreciate that. I'm not intimidated by him and I argue with him quite a bit because I don't think he's right about a lot of the stuff he says to me. But you know, when someone argues with you and they do it respectfully, like you can tell, like it's like a fair fight, you know, especially someone who has a little bit more power than you do. That's what it is.
So what's the roadmap to, you said, you know, getting to where you want to go? Is it more press? Is it just bigger checks from wealthier investors? Are you targeting athletes? I know you go to the games now. So like what's the roadmap to get to that $100 million, $300 million, whatever your goal is to break that ceiling?
Yeah, we have been in great conversations with major banks, Goldman Sachs, JP Morgan, Bank of America. Bank of America is already an investor of ours. Again, I'll say it one more time, I get into arguments with them. So that's part of it, right? But I think Bank of America kind of broke the mold for us by investing seven figures, because then Goldman Sachs and JP Morgan and SVB and the rest of them can, you know, understand what it is. So I think it's going to be that. I also think it's going to be a lot of family offices. So, you know, I think that that's where we play best, because it isn't super traditional.
Can you talk about that? So a lot of people, even some of the conversations we've been having over the past 6 to 12 months, the words family offices have come up in conversation. But for a lot of population, they have no idea what that is. Could you just break that down?
Family office is essentially like a fund within a family or a group of families. It's treated as a company or an entity, a funding entity. And so you might have like Jay-Z, for instance. He's making investments out of his venture fund. And that's kind of specific, but he has people working there and it's very specific LPs are in. But he probably also has the Jay-Z and Beyonce family office where they make their own investments. And they have somebody, at least one person, if not seven people, running the numbers on that and treating it. And it's just your own allocation. Like, for instance, one of my major goals maybe by the time I'm 45, I only have a couple of years, is to have a family office. And it's different from angel investing, because we're talking usually millions of dollars. You can't have a family office with like $500K. You're talking millions of dollars, if not tens or hundreds of millions of dollars. And you're investing directly out of that. And it's productized and has organization around it. And so those are the reason we don't know about them is because they're real stealth. They're on purpose. They're meant to be, you know, if somebody knew that a certain, it doesn't have to be like a celebrity, if anybody, you have a family office that can deploy $50 million a year or $20 million a year, they're going to be hounded because they don't have that shield of this is an entity, a business over here. It's like family office sounds very intimate and accessible. So they don't want it to be. So they're not going to put up a website, most likely. They're not going to do that. And what a lot of times a family office is, too, is like they'll realize that they can only do so much as a philanthropist. You know, they can only move the needle so much. But if they, instead of putting, or in addition to putting their money as, you know, into charity, if they put it into companies, it can be evergreen. So if a family has, you know, a big family has $100 million that they want to spend over time, and they're used to putting $80 million of that into charity, that goes away because it's spent. And it just kind of goes away. They have to refill the coffers. But if they have a family office that's making a return on investment over 5, 7, 15 years, they never have to replenish that if they play it right. So that's what they're going after. Mm. And a lot of times you'll see these rich families combine their family offices so that it's one group, like 5 to 10 people who are hired by them to run 4 or 5, 10 family offices at once.
So as far as you personally, you have other stuff that you're into. Mm-hmm. So you have the podcast, you have the book, different campaigns. Talk about that. And like, you know, a lot of times people only focus on one thing. What made you want to go and start doing other things? Was it to raise visibility for your fund, or was it just something that passionate that you just wanted to just do?
It was when I was learning about venture, I didn't see anybody who looked like me teaching. Like all my teachers from books and things were white men who now are investors in my fund or friends, right? But I didn't see me. So that was part of it. It's like, again, like every day of my life, I get this feedback. Something I did in 2018 helped this person, right? So it's that visibility. But then before even like the creator economy was a big thing, I looked at it in 2015 and I said, when I did that blog post and so many opportunities came my way for the people I was helping, I have to be visible. You know, if you have decades and decades of mostly white men in an 80 or so year old industry who have all of the purse strings, they control all the money, they control everything, and they also control the voice of this industry. We got to have other people talking. That's why John Henry did his show. You know, that's why he's all over social when he, when you know, back and forth there. So I looked at that 2016 and I said, I'm going to take some of the stuff I learned in previous lives where I was jumping on, you know, MySpace and, you know, had blogs and all kinds of stuff. I'm going to use that to bring opportunity. Again, I didn't have that much money, so you become money. So that's what it was. And I think you did ask me before, I don't think I answered it completely, which is like, what do I want? But beyond the money, I do want the work that we have done at Backstage, our founders, and my story to be known by more people. Because I see the impact it has. You can't deny the impact. Like, we have helped create countless, you know this, we were just talking about this, right? Mm-hmm. You know what this is like. We've helped create countless companies and, you know, get people hired and change their lives. So of course I want more and more people to know about that.
One of those ventures is HireRunner.co.
Yeah.
Can you talk about that?
So HireRunner.co, so for 7 years I ran Backstage, still do, but I ran Backstage and I had to hyper-focus. You have to hyper-focus if you're going to do something big, right? So I focused on that. But I'm also an entrepreneur, and I was that first. And so I kept having this calling back to, I want to do something where I can at least be out there and like be in the trenches with the founders I'm investing in, because that also helps me become a better investor. So I said, what would be aligned so that it's not pulling away from what I'm doing? So I thought about the things that I get asked for the most. The number one thing I get asked for, I'm sure you can imagine, is money. Every day of my life, like I think the driver pitched me on the way here. Like, I had my headphones in and I was like, oh, okay. I get pitched every day, all day long. Just like you all probably get pitched to be on your show. I get pitched, can you invest in my company? But the number two, very close after that, is I need help. Like, I need to hire somebody, or I don't know what I don't know. And so it was about people. So HireRunner.co helps connect mostly fractional, meaning part-time and kind of gig economy operators, like executive assistants, chiefs of staff, COOs, et cetera, with companies of all sizes. So from the solopreneur to the Fortune 500 company, we have them all as customers. And then in about a month and a half, we're launching our app, which will be kind of similar to what Fiverr does, or in Fiverr, I would say that's the one I want to compare to, where you can go on the app, you have something that you need, maybe you need an EA for a month, you go, we find the person for you, we match you, and then you're off to the races, so you can start the next day.
So you're sure 1,000 new millionaires, what's that?
My goal is to help create and catalyze 1,000 new millionaires. UBS says that in 2017, or by 2017, there will be 80 million millionaires in the world. There are about 57 million today. And so that's like 10 million plus in, over the next years, plus the ones that will fall off. And, you know, so that's at least 10 million, maybe 12 million a year. I know 1,000 for some people feels like a low number. But I say 1,000 because I juxtapose it against the billionaire. So we have billionaire friends. We know that they're cool, but I don't know if anybody needs that much money. And so, like, what if 1,000 people had the same amount of money just as a to get started, right? Doesn't mean I want you to stop there, but just like, what if 1,000 people had like enough and had more than enough? What could we influence? What policy could we influence? Quality of life would be lifted. I believe that's my thesis. So that a lot of people are like, why isn't a million? And I say, I want to track it. I want to literally be able to tell you the names of the people that I helped and we helped create, turn into millionaires by teaching you how to generate revenue and all the things. And if I said a million, it would just be this sort of pie in the sky thing that is more inspirational than tactical.
Is there a global initiative or a plan to expand globally for both Backstage Capital and HireRunner.co?
So both of them, so Backstage invests in outside the country. We have six companies we've invested in that out of England who are African founders. Mm-hmm. And we don't have a mandate on where we can invest. I think for us, so we had an open location in London for half a year in 2019. We were going to expand and then COVID happened. And so we stopped the expansion. But I think for us, it's just always been about resources. Like, we get asked to go everywhere. And like, you can imagine, we get at, like, any country in the world, you can imagine the same thing is happening for some group of people. So they're saying, can you come here? Like in France, we've had, can you come to Paris and like build something in Paris? Or can you come to the outskirts in France that nobody's heard of, but we can do the same thing here because we're not getting it. India, parts of Asia, Australia, everybody, indigenous people have asked us to come. My thing is, I want to do that and I would love to do that with the resources, and we will. But I also know that there are incredible companies in St. Louis who are being overlooked. I also know that there are incredible companies in Jackson, Mississippi, Chicago, Seattle, you know, North Carolina, all the things. And for the rest of my life, I could do this work and I would not, you know, scratch the surface. So I think that there's definitely a strategy that we need to deepen our well. And we need to deepen our well by, over the next 2 or so years, at least tripling our assets under management. And then we can kind of sprout from there all of the different things that I've wanted to do.
I think you sit in a unique position, right? If you've invested in over 200 companies, predominantly in tech. So I wonder, from your vantage point, what, obviously we know AI, generative AI, are there other trends that we should be looking for in technology? And if so, how should entrepreneurs be using it to their advantage in their businesses?
Yeah, I think AI is, I don't think anybody quite has, I think everybody's underestimating the power of AI. I always just, you know, try to keep up with the best I can. I've never been good at looking for trends. I've been good at telling, like seeing around corners. Mm-hmm. So for instance, I couldn't tell you, it's the same thing with like clothing and fashion. Like, I don't know what's cool, but sometimes I accidentally find things that are cool and they're like, oh, your shoes are incredible. I'm like, I accidentally picked these up because they're pretty, you know? Mm-hmm. So for me, when I think about the way people who are, let's even say 50 plus, it's probably even lower than that, but like 50 is not elderly, but like elderly people, then people who are retiring and then people who are leaving their businesses and they don't have anybody to hand it off to, people who are in companies, anybody who's 50 over, they're just discounted. You all are probably too young to remember the dinosaur TV show on ABC.
I remember that.
You remember that? Yeah. You remember the episode?
I came on after the Wonder
Years. Yes, there's an episode where they have like the grandma who was a trip, by the way. I think the grandma was black, but anyway, that the grandma was, it was a tradition that when you get a certain age, you just throw the grand people off into the tar pits. And it was just like a tradition, and the husband was real excited because it was like that day, you know, and they did something to kind of turn it around so that she didn't have to get thrown into the tar pits. But I kind of think that's what we do with like older people. And obviously the older I get, we all get older, but the older I get and the higher in age I get, the more I'm like, what's going to happen? Like, what's going to happen to me in 20 years and whatever? I'll probably be okay. But I think there's so much that we are discounting and missing out and underestimating when it comes to older people and the wisdom that they have and the skill that they have. And I think that things that are both for like entrepreneurship for older people, like that help with that, and things that are for, you know, end of life, like everything in between, I think that's where I would be putting a lot of money.
Well, Lauren, thank you for coming. How can the people follow your journey? What's your social media handles and any other information?
Yeah, thank you. So Arlan is my name, A-R-L-A-N, and I'm at Arlan Was Here on Instagram. That's where I spend most of my time, on LinkedIn too. But you can go to backstagecapital.com to see our portfolio. Check that out. You can also apply on backstagecapital.com. Most funds don't let you apply on their website. Apply for investment if you think your company is viable for
it. What's the minimum to be an investor?
To be an investor, usually something around 50K. Wow. But again, I'm just going to say this. I am not allowed to say that, like talk about it in that way. I am not soliciting, but hypothetically, that's in the past when it's been.
Disclaimer.
I'm just saying, it's just, you know, because there are some funds that I have that we've had in the past that you can talk about in press. They're just a different designation. And then there are others that you can't. And, you know, SEC don't play. They just don't play.
The Alphabet Boys do not play. Any more books? coming?
Yeah, so I have It's About Damn Time came out in 2020. Your First Million came out this year. Mm-hmm. Please pick that up, because I think that'll explain everything. And it kind of, the bigger picture, and I know I've talked a lot about myself today, but my thing is, like, I could just drop the mic right now. I want us to win. I want so many of us who don't understand how valuable they are, or we are, to win. So the book is really meant for that. So Your First Million. And then I do plan on putting out a third book in the next couple of years. Another thing I just want to make sure everybody knows is that I have an event coming up April 9th through the 12th in Los Angeles. It's called Your First Million Live. We have Issa Rae. We have Rich Paul. Again, y'all, just a lot of, like, some stuff that, yeah, there. Exactly. We have Humble coming through, because we talked about y'all a few days ago.
Just little.
Yeah. And we have Sheila Johnson, the first Black woman billionaire. We have TLC is closing out the event. It's at the Peacock Theater, where the Emmys were held a few days ago. Nice. Yeah. So it is Your First Million. It's just going to be really, we want it to be super informative, and there's a lot of financial literacy there. It's about getting your coin, right? But it's also this inspirational place where we can convene. The networking is like crazy. I just want to say, I know I'm taking up a lot of y'all's time, but I just want to say, just watching, I watched your event 2 years ago from my home, because I wasn't traveling. Mm. But I watched it on, like, the big screen, and I just couldn't believe it. It was just so inspiring. And then this follow-up, right? I just think it definitely was an inspiration for what I wanted to do an event for years, but it's definitely seeing you all and seeing the impact, and it's hearing about it, you know, through the grapevine. A lot of your followers kind of follow what I do. Just hearing about it, I asked people when they were there, how's it going, you know? It really inspired me. And I just, there's nobody else, you all know this, but there's no one else who can put together, what, you had 20,000 people?
Yeah.
But even the year before, was it
14,000?
Yeah. Even that to me was just like, that was like your moment. I was like, oh, this is crazy. And I heard y'all say on stage on last year, you said, why aren't these major sponsors in the room? And I said out loud, I was by myself. I said out loud, I know how to make that happen. Like, you know, the sponsors are coming to my event. Like, let's bridge that gap, you know, like, because there's no reason these sponsors, like, you have great ally and all these sponsors, but there's no reason most of the people I work with shouldn't know what you're doing, because it's incredible. And there's nothing like it here, Toronto, London. There's nothing like that.
We appreciate that.
Thank you. Appreciate it. Yeah, definitely. Yeah. We could collab for sure. For sure. For sure. Well, make sure you go April 9th, you said?
April 9th through the 12th. If you only can make a couple of days, go the 10th and 11th. This is going to be amazing.
And what's the website for that?
Yourfirstmillion.live.
Yourfirstmillion.live. Get your tickets now, ladies and gentlemen. And thank you guys for rocking with us. We'll see you next week. Peace.
Peace.
Springtime savings are in full bloom, all in the Kroger app. Buy one, get one free on flavorful, fresh Tyson chicken during our full line sale. Then mix or match during our 99-cent sale and get Kraft mac and cheese, Campbell's soup, or Bar-S Franks for 99 cents each when you buy five or more, all with your card. Shop these deals at your local Kroger today, or tap the screen now to download the Kroger app to save big today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Prices and product availability subject to change. Restrictions apply. See site for details.